Hello, Diamond Da Vinci's listeners. This is Teresa, your friendly neighborhood producer and co-host. Did you notice something odd about our last podcast? Yeah. Somehow, the Out of the Park interview never made it in. Which is funny, because I know I edited it, and I know I put it all together. I do remember the computer hiccuping, but I don't know. I don't honestly know what happened. So it turns out it shouldn't have been as short as it was. But the good news is, you get a bonus, kinda. You get a whole extra section of podcast to listen to this week. Huzzah! You can thank me later. Sorry about this, guys. Hope everything's going well this week. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
And welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, it's August, and that means it's time for the Little League World Series. It's all things youth baseball and softball on today's show.
As with many youth leagues, or even adult league recreation ball, volunteers must do their part in maintaining the ball diamonds they play on. So what tools are an absolute must for an organization to have on hand in order to perform the work needed to keep their fields in decent shape? We'll talk about that in our first segment, Tools of the Trade.
And on today's Out of the Park segment, we'll interview two people in the turf profession who have helped raise the field standards over the past couple of decades at the Little League World Series site in South Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
Then we'll close things out with a special segment where we're going to specifically look at fundraising. Oh, it's always fun to talk about money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's and, one of and, the...
Huh? And everybody always needs it.
That's right. Everybody always wants more.
We'll have all that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Well, hello, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, and I'm joined by Teresa Beyer, my talented co-host and producer for the show. Welcome, Teresa. How are you today?
Well, hello, Paul. I'm feeling a little better today. I'm going to take a minute here, if you don't mind. I want to apologize to our listeners for the last couple of podcasts we've put out have been a little late, and it's totally my fault. Actually, no, it's not my fault. It's the fault of the little being that's growing in my belly. sorry, folks. I've been a little sick over the last couple of months, and it finally got to me the last few weeks. And I'm getting better. We're getting better. And we are expecting little DeVito, number 2, February 8th-ish. And hopefully, little DeVito, number 2, will stop getting in the way of this podcast.
Well, at some point or another, that'll happen, whether it's now or 8-10 years from now. We'll see.
That's true.
I don't think the birth is going to slow it down, that's for sure.
No, not usually, unfortunately. But by then, I can get a babysitter.
That's true. Well, speaking of children, we're going to focus on the podcast today is going to be the focus on youth movement, specifically youth baseball and softball. I've spent a lot of time involved with a little league organization since 2002, and have lots of experience in many facets of that type of an operation. So I can fully appreciate what a lot of these leagues go through. And Teresa, you're just years away from it.
And I used to play t-ball, so I have tons of experience as well.
Oh, yeah. It's so different when you're the adult in the house, and you got parents who are going over the top, and you know there's so much fun to look forward to when you get to that.
Yeah, I've always wondered which is worse, the little guys who are playing in their parents, or the big boys when they are playing in minor league baseball. I can't decide who throws more fits sometimes.
I've done both, and I'll have to say the little league parents are probably worse than the big boys.
Well, you haven't done minor leagues, Paul.
Well, that's true. I haven't done minor leagues. That's the one section I haven't done. But yeah. You know, I will say I've actually had more satisfaction doing the volunteer work that I do for the youth league than I ever felt working in Major League Baseball. You know, it's easy up at the high levels because you've got everything you need. You got the money you need most of the time to do what you got to do to the field. And you got a great field. You got, you know, nowadays they're all sand-based. They all drain well. But at the youth league levels, you know, a lot of times you have nothing or very little, and the fields are in various stages of disrepair. But, you know, the players, the coaches, the fans, they don't expect the perfect fields when they come to a youth park. And that's been my...
So when you give it to them, they're just...
Yeah, they're just blown away. And that's what we've done. You know, when I started at our little league back in 2002, the facility was in a state of disrepair. And it was, for me, it wasn't hard to... make it better. But to the people, it was like, holy cow, you mean it could be this way? You know, I had to do some convincing of the board members and stuff, but the look on the kids' faces and the parents when they see the facility, and I always hear the comment of, oh, it's too bad the kids don't realize how good they've got it here. And
oh, they do.
The thing is, they do. The parents don't realize that the kids understand how good it feels, especially if that kid's playing travel ball as well, or they get on the all-star teams and they have to go play at other facilities. I've had kids come back and tell me what's wrong with other facilities' fields. you know, so kids do realize when they're playing on a really good field, and it's amazing. But it's just, you know, we've done tournaments at our complex, and we just finished one back 2 weeks ago, but I've had tournaments where people just stand there, people from other organizations whose teams are playing in the tournament, they'll just stand there in awe watching our ground crew work the field like a Major League Baseball pregame, doing what we'll have 5, 6, 7 guys there working, getting the field ready for the game and, you know, pregame watering and all this kind of stuff. And people, I had a coach one time in one of our Little League district tournaments that we held, bought the entire team out to the coach's box. And had them stand there and watch us as we fixed the entire
field. Wow.
It's like, holy cow, this is really interesting. You know, so they do take an interest and they do appreciate what you do. And that's really the part that we like the best about it. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's
always nice to feel appreciated.
You don't get that warm, fuzzy feeling as much, in my opinion. I'm with the Major.
Not really.
And you don't get as many people.
You get yelled at for bad hops, whether they're your fault or not.
You don't get as many people coming up to you and saying how great the place looks or how great it plays, and thanking your ground crew. Because at the Major level, it's expected. Mm-hmm. It's not expected at the youth level.
Yeah,
so
that's a good point.
It's great for my crew to hear that kind of stuff.
So. Let's move on into our first segment of the day.
Let's talk about
some of the tools of the trade.
Yeah. So the theme, of course, is again, the youth ball fields. And I get a lot of questions from customers calling here at Beacon over the years about, you know, what tools do I need to have? And, you know, that's kind of an open-ended question because... that's my second favorite question I get around here. My other one is always, how much does it cost to build a ball field? Well, you want to talk about an open-ended question. There's a big one.
Yeah, but that's true. Yeah, money comes into both answers, though.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. And so the question is, how much money do you have to spend? Because I can't answer that question until you can tell me how much money you've got. So,
well, all right. So let's pretend I have $500. Oh, that'd be nice. I'd probably go buy an iPad, though.
You've got kids. You're not allowed to have money for the next 20 years.
It's true. All right. So I've got $500 to spend on my kids' field.
Okay. So let's say you're a youth league and you've got nothing, absolutely nothing. You need some tools. You got to think about, okay, what's the basics I got to have to get a ball game underway? Well, we got to have a smooth infield and I got to have foul lines.
Yep.
So if you're talking $500, by the time you spend... the cost of getting a bare bones chalker of decent caliber.
Right.
For instance, you can the Beacon Streamliner, the two wheel Streamliner chalker. Okay.
Right.
About $335. You throw in a 6 foot rigid drags, another 165. Boom. You're at $500 right off the bat. It's that easy to blow that kind of money. Mm-hmm. But you know, those are two critical things that you have to have in order to get the game. Get the game going. So you've blown that $500 pretty quick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so let's say I'm a master at fundraising and I can get about $1,000.
If you're a master at fundraising, I wouldn't call a grand a master. But okay.
If you're starting from scratch and you've got a league that's never had anything before, and now you've got to convince them to finally spend money for the first time ever, $1,000 is a really good goal.
Okay, so with $1,000, I'd stick with the drag. Okay, you got the drag, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'd stick with the streamliner, but I'd go from the two wheel to the three wheel just because people have a better time working with a three-wheel streamliner than a two-wheel. The reason why I went with a two-wheel originally is just because of cost.
Mm-hmm.
So then from there, you're talking to go to this three-wheel streamliner, you're talking an extra $25. So that puts us at $525 right there. That's half your money gone. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I'd add an iron rake for $45, an aluminum long tooth grading rake for $59,
mm-hmm.
a sifter scoop shovel for $92. A set of puddle sponges for $85.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go with a wooden handle tamp, which are the cheapest of the tamps, mainly because you're trying to conserve money as much as possible.
Money.
Yep. Yeah. So an 8-inch tamp, it's going to be about $49. And then I go with a steel mat mop. That's a piece of steel drag on a stick, basically.
Yep.
Used for small areas like the
base hitting your corners
and the mound, that kind of stuff along the edges of the infield.
Mm-hmm.
So that's $115. And finally, you got about $30 left. Now this last piece, you could go either way. You could go $32 for a scuffle hoe, or some people know them as a hula hoe.
Okay. I was just going to ask what a scuffle hoe was.
Yeah,
I usually know them as a hoop hoe.
A hula hoe. Yeah. And most of them that, or you could take that money and spend that money on a fan rake. Now, justification for some of these tools. Obviously, first of all, the fan rake. Yeah, because you got to take care of the lips. And if I look at those two, I'd probably opt more towards that. But some people,
unless I had Bermuda grass, then I'd want that hoe.
Then you want the scuffle hoe, exactly, for the edging. So that last piece is kind of a, maybe you can find some of these other tools that you could switch off and so you could have both of those tools. It all depends on your particular situation.
So wait, I have another question for you. The scoop shovel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was in the minors and basically we had about $1,000 to spend, we did not use a scoop shovel. How do you use a scoop shovel? Where do you find the most benefit comes from that? The sifter scoop shovel. We used just a regular scoop and, we had minimal amounts of calcined clay that we could put on our field. So, I mean, that's where I would think you would be using your sifter, but I want to make sure that I'm thinking along the right lines.
But you'd also use it for, if you didn't have a top dressing, if you got stones in the field, where are you going to have the most stones when you're done dragging and you pick up the drag and you've got all the spoils there? You've got to rake it out and get the stuff out. You could use a sifter shovel. If you're on the mound and home plate, you got
clay.
Chunks laying there from the day before. You want to rake those out, scoop them up with the sifter shovel, leave the good dirt behind and get rid of the chunks. So there's a lot of things, or as I call it, the holy shovel, because many times we're praying.
You're praying. Well, and that's a good point and something I didn't think of. Even just a step up into the low A minor leagues, we've got a different infield mix and we're not as likely to have as many impurities in it. So that's a really good point on that shovel. Thanks.
Right. But at the youth end, you're dealing with crappy fields. You got all kinds, you're getting
who
grass in your drag and all this kind of stuff. And the sifter shovel will take care of most of that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a really handy tool, or you can call it again, the holy shovel, as we like to call it, because it's full of holes.
Yep.
The iron rake is for cutting down if you have to repair a mound and home plate, whether you're using clay or just regular soil, you might have to cut down high spots. Or you might use your iron rake to take out some lips. If your lips have built up and they've kind of been glued in by rain or irrigation, you sharpen those tines on those rakes and you shave those out just like you're shaving your face. And it's another way of keeping your lips under control so they don't end up being, a foot high.
And for do-it-yourself Three Stooges action, just leave it sitting the wrong way in the grass and that'll be
fun.
Yes,
that's the first thing you teach your crew is how not, like, that was the first thing Pat Sanderon taught me and everybody else on the crew. And anytime he spotted a rake that was facing the wrong way, you heard about it from
good
him.
For him. Yeah, that's dangerous.
So
that's
getting back to the list, so we had the aluminum tooth grading rake, obviously your normal grooming rake, everybody's got to have one of those for the fields. just for your hand raking work. Mm-hmm. We talked about the sifter, scoop, shovel, the puddle sponges. Another thing that's really critical for any organization. I don't care what level you're at, because the last thing you want to do is have people using brooms to sweep excess water off a field. Mm. Because what happens when you do that? You take soil along with it and you build up your lips on the edges because that soil gets deposited and gets glued in with the water. So that's a no-no. We don't do that ever at any level. And so you want the sponge. The sponges work really great. You put them in a puddle and step on them a couple times. It'll suck the suck the water up, flip it over. You can do the same thing. It'll suck more up. Then you just walk over into the grass area, wring it out, take it right back over and start over again. And yeah, they work fabulous.
And that's not the same as a cocoa mat. Cocoa mat is used for grooming and all of that, you know, yes, with right. and without water. But cocoa mats are not used for drying out a field and should not be used that way.
No. So puddle sponges, I think, are an absolute must. Once you get past the bare bones basic, you got to have some of these things to help get the excess water off. Don't, you know, if you've got puddles on your field in these youth leagues and recreational leagues, if you got a puddle on the field, you go, well, I'll just go get 7 bags of drying agent and throw it on there.
That's expensive. A lot more expensive than a sponge.
Very expensive fix. So you get rid of the excess water first, and then you find you don't use as much of the drying agent then to do the final drying of that area.
And the more drying agent you need, the lower quality you have to buy, and that just ends up, again, eating at your budget again and again and again.
Then we also had the tamp, of course. If you're fixing some holes in the mound, you're going to need a tamp. The steel mat mop, like I was talking about, is a piece of steel mat drag that's put on a handle. And the nice thing about those is
what is that, 2x2, 3x3?
No, it's 2x18.
Okay.
2 feet wide by 18 inches deep. And so you can use it for down the baselines.
Mm-hmm.
To finish groom your baselines. You can use it on the mound because of its flexibility, it'll form the shape of the mound. And because it's only 2 feet wide, it's not a problem. There's another tool called a cocoa mop, which is the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's got a 2 foot wide by 18 inch deep piece of cocoa mat, which will also work good for the same things, for the mound and baseline. So you could do either one of those, but that tool actually works better. The cocoa mop actually works better if you have a top dressing on your field.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these youth leagues and recreational league fields are not going to typically have top dressing on them, so that's why I stuck with the steel mat.
Yep. So. Well, and honestly, those cocoa mats, they take a little finesse to learn how to use and to use them properly. I don't trust my ability with those. You know, so some people love them, and good. That's great. If they can use them properly, that's great.
Yep.
But
there is a little bit of a learning curve with them, but once you learn how to handle it, it can be done.
Absolutely.
Now, the one thing you'll notice I didn't have in there was any kind of a nail drag.
Yeah.
And that's because in leagues where you don't have any money, what do?
Buy some nails.
You build your own. Some 2x4s and some nails. It doesn't have to be pretty wood. It's just got to be wood that you can build it with, and we will try and put a link, and I think I've got that set up already. I don't, but...
There's no try, only do. I will find
yes,
it.
Yes, that's correct, and I know they're out there, but we'll put a link on how to build your own nail drags, because I know there are some on the internet.
Yep.
So that you've got that also if you're dealing with that type of a situation.
I'll put that in the notes for me.
But yeah, that's the kind of thing you can make your own, and then when you have money, you can go get the more expensive, pretty ones.
Pretty.
But that's where you start out with. And, you know, when I started at our little league, we had nothing. We had a shed, an old concession shed that was built there back in 64. The mice were eating away at the 2x4 studs.
Lovely.
It was so bad. And we had barely any tools. And now...
Just you. Sorry.
Yeah. Now we walk into my place. Funny girl. Now we walk into our place and we've got tons of tools. I mean, we're better outfitted than most minor parks. I mean, it's
you were better outfitted than I was. Yep.
But part of that's because of what we did financially to get to that point. And well, I'll cover that after our out of the park interview, how we achieved that and what you need to do in order to get to that point. But you got to start slow and look long haul, long run. You got to have a long range plan. That's the secret to those kind of things. And we'll cover that in the second half of this show. For all of you Diamond Da Vinci's out there who are busy this time of year painting your fields, whether it be for baseball, soccer, or the upcoming football season, Beacon Athletics can help you complete your on-field masterpieces. We have a full offering of string lines, stencils, templates, painting machines, and paint. Beacon can provide custom field stencils to promote your organization, club, or school. Then, to paint it, we offer various bulk paints like Beacon's own Dazzle line, or try the likes of World Class or Combi premium paints with many vibrant colors available. And for touch-ups, we also have World Class and Goal Line brand aerosol turf paints. To apply your bulk paints, Beacon carries the top-of-the-line Graco Field Laser S100 or the Powerliner 850 airless line sprayers. These gas-powered machines can handle the big jobs, but for the smaller jobs, we also have the battery-powered Field Laser S90 and the Combi. So let your creative imagination run wild. Check out our web store at www.beaconathletics.com or call our experienced sales staff at 800-747-5985 and let us help equip you with your brushes, paint, and palette to bring your masterpieces alive. And today's Out of the Park segment welcomes Don Fowler, a retired Penn State Turfgrass Extension agent, and his son, Jeff Fowler, following in his dad's footstep. He's a current Penn State Turfgrass Extension agent. Together, they've spent their August over the past 20 years helping, well, more than 20 years, actually, helping Little League International maintain their championship field for the Real World Series. That's the one for Little League. Together with the staff of volunteers and the head groundskeeper of the facility, they immaculately groom the Little League Volunteer Stadium and Howard J. Is it Lamad? Is that how that's pronounced? Lamad?
Lamady.
Oh, Lamady. That's interesting.
Yes.
Lamady Stadium. Their field surface in preparation for the teams of 11 and 12-year-olds from all over the world who come to play for the title of the champion in front of the worldwide television audience. Jeff is at it again this year as the tournament week rapidly approaches, and I'd like to welcome both Don and Jeff to the show. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Don, I'm going to start with you because you have the most history in this. How and when did your relationship start with Little League International?
It began in the spring of 1995, when the Keystone Athletic Field Managers Organization was just formed, and the Little League people at Williamsport had heard of this organization, and they were interested in rebuilding Lamady Stadium for the 50th anniversary of Little League, which was in the August of 1996. And they called us in 95 and said, could you help us? And our president, Dan Douglas, at the time said, yes, I think we can. And at that time, they asked me, I had just retired, and they asked me if I could go up there and kind of be the clerk of works between the contractors and Little League. And that's how we got involved. And after we rebuilt the stadium for that first time, they asked me would I come back and help maintain it during the series. And we've been going to do that ever since.
So it's been a partnership then between between CAFMO, basically, and Little League International, it sounds like.
It is it is between CAFMO and Little League International, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, what were the conditions when you first saw the facility for the first time? What was the shape of the field at Lamad Stadium?
Actually, I didn't see it when it was at its worst. I didn't get there until it had already been torn apart and they started to redo it. But I understand and seeing pictures that lips on the infield were 10 to 12 inches high. Grass was spotty, and they had this anniversary coming up and wanted to make sure that it was better than it had been. And if you can imagine what 10 to 12 inch lips would be, the condition of that field was not very playable for the 50th anniversary of the organization.
And I'm trying to think, were the games televised back then?
No.
Nationally? No, they weren't. Okay.
They were not. Hmm. They didn't start televising games, I don't think, until 1996, the 50th anniversary.
Okay.
Anytime before that, I don't think. Now, I might be wrong on that, but I don't think they were televised other than locally, maybe. But nationally, no.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing they got those rebuilt just before they started putting on national television, I can tell you that. are the fields used during the rest of the year, or are they strictly saved just for the tournaments, during the week of the tournaments?
That's a good question. No, they're used all summer long. They have summer camps there
for
6 to 8 weeks in the summertime, and those kids, although they play most of the time on a lot of the other practice fields, they're allowed to play a game or two on the stadium field, and that's all summer long. So we have about 2 weeks from the time summer camps are over until the series starts to get the fields back in shape. And at that point, they were showing some wear after the summer camps.
Sure, sure.
Paul, they also get used for local district championships, both softball and baseball.
Sure.
At all age levels. So those fields have the equivalent of a major league home season played on them before the World Series starts.
Yeah, so about 80 games or so?
Right.
Or are you talking a full major league home and away, 160 games?
No, a home stand or a home season.
Okay, so about 80 games.
About 80 games. Yeah, about 80 games a year.
Okay.
Before the series starts.
Sure. So your planning for this then really starts when? Involvement.
I send out the first letter to potential volunteers is normally sent the first week of February, preparing for August for the August tournament.
Mm-hmm.
But we correspond throughout the rest of that year, just trying to work together a schedule to make sure we have enough volunteers.
And is there a certain number that you look for of volunteers that you'd like to have on hand?
With two stadiums, now that the tournament has gone to 16 teams, when TAPMO originally started, it was 8 teams and one field. Now we're at two stadiums and 16 teams. We need to have about an 8-person crew per stadium to get done what we need to get done. So I try to manage those now to have about 16 there at a time. Some of us are there for the entire 2 weeks, and others take off a couple of days' work and can come. So we try to juggle around 7 or 8 folks for each field throughout the course of the entire tournament.
Do you find that most of the people from year to year are returning? They come back, and it's the same people helping every year?
Yeah, we have a very solid core of volunteers who come back every year. The ones that have, a lot of them have been there since 94, 95,
wow,
when we started this relationship. There's probably 10 or so people that have been around since the beginning. About 6 years ago, we actually created a couple of positions that rotate because the interest in volunteering at the Little League World Series on the grounds crew there's a lot of people that would love to help out. So we actually created a couple of rotating positions. So it's a 2-year rotation. So this year we'll bring in a couple of new folks and we'll have them there to kind of show them the ropes and what to expect. And next year they come back and help out, and then we rotate them off and bring in other volunteers who are interested in doing that as well.
Hmm.
So
now how about vendors? Do you get a lot of vendors willing to come in and help or provide supplies free of charge or anything like that?
We have a number of vendors who are very good to us as the grounds crew. We do reach out to them for financial support to help feed the crew throughout the course of the 2-week series. And then we also have other companies who donate product and services.
Very nice.
And we have a couple of vendors that come in and help out. So it's a great public relations opportunity and all kinds of things.
Well, and that's the thing. It's not just organizing the crew, but it's organizing the work schedule. It's organizing how you're going to feed all these people. I mean, there's obviously a great amount of organization that has to go into this kind of an undertaking.
Yeah, and one of the, I mean, we provide housing to the volunteers that come in, so coordinating between Little League and our crew as to when they're coming in, so we make sure we have enough beds for everybody. Those 30 uniforms and hats and the whole nine yards of things that need to be done.
Sure. So then what is the typical day during the tournament, not before the tournament when you got the prep going on, but during the tournament, how many games a day are played on each of the stadium fields? And, are your guys working, a 12, 16-hour shift like you do in Major League Baseball, or are they working more like 8 or 10 hours, or maybe you have two shifts of crew working each day?
We have one shift. We hit the fields about 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. And start prepping them. And I say fields, not only do we assist with the two stadium fields, but there are also three practice fields on the complex and two in a neighboring community park that mm-hmm. all the teams use for practice in the mornings before games
yep.
or on their
yep.
days off during the tournament. So we prep those, fix mounts, fix batters, boxes. There's a bullpen area near the batting cages that we prep or repair after use the day before. So that stuff typically gets done first thing in the morning, starting at about 7 a.m. And the two stadiums both would host two games a day. So there are four total games a day at the two.
Okay.
Except with the double elimination tournament. There's one day, I think, that there's five games, but for the most part, it's four games a day. So it's typical baseball, get everything done and then hurry up and wait.
Yeah, exactly.
And then once they're done with the game, it's hurry up and get it ready for the next game and then wait for the game to end.
Mm-hmm. What is?
You do a mid-game drag similar to Major
League
Baseball.
Sure.
So we're there from 7 a.m. and we're typically the ones that turn out the lights after the last pitch is thrown and the last piece of garbage is picked up.
Sure. What kind of a time span is there between the two games? And are the teams that are coming in for the second game allowed to take are they allowed to take infield practice or anything like that?
Yeah, the schedule changed considerably when we went to two stadiums.
Yeah.
When we were on one stadium, had eight teams, the games were 10, 2, 4, and 8. And you had very little prep time. So if you had, if you had a game that went extra innings or took particularly long, the prep time in between was very minimal.
Sure.
When we went to two stadiums, when Little League went to two stadiums, it gives us about an hour between games.
Oh, nice.
So a typical day would be, the 1 o'clock game will be on Volunteer Stadium. The 4 o'clock game will be on Lomedy Stadium. The 6 o'clock game will be back on Volunteer, and the 8 o'clock will be on Lomedy. So, there's a little bit of about an hour window in there that we can prep.
Mm-hmm.
Again, baseball, depending on extra innings, depending on length of innings, depending on all that stuff. But we do get, each team then gets a 15-minute warm-up. Prior to, so if a game starts at 1 o'clock, we have to have the field ready for them basically at noon, so they can start their pregame warm-ups and TV shoots, and ESPN always wants their time to, do the pregame footage of the starting pitcher or the big hitter, do their thing.
I think it's important to think about the fact that this whole schedule is TV driven.
Yes, of course.
It always is these days. It's amazing how much TV does drive a lot of the decisions that are being made out on our fields, whether you're working for little boys or you're working for big boys.
that's a good point.
Well, go ahead.
We've had as little as 7 minutes between games.
Wow.
What can you do in 7 minutes?
You can take the brooms out there and drag the infield and put down lines and say play ball.
Yeah,
exactly.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, and now with the two stadiums, you're alternating, Jeff. back and forth. So wouldn't that leave you more time to prep the other field while the other one's being played, though?
Yeah, and that we split the crew. So you know, we have, you know, half a crew. You know, we have seven or eight down on one field and seven or eight up on the other. So absolutely, we have a lot more time to prep. So you know, right from the get go in the morning. Very rarely do we cross over, and it's not because we don't like each other. It's just because we have responsibilities at our own field. And so we'll report right to our stadium, and you know, the game manager is there, and he's kind of going over the schedule for the day with us. So we much more laid back now that we're at two stadiums than it was when we were trying to pump four games through one field.
Sure.
For 9 days straight.
Yeah. So there's a rain
factor that plays in all this.
And that's what I was just getting to, Don. I was going to say, so what happens then when rain suddenly threatens? Can a split crew handle the tarps on each field, or do you need the full crew to handle each tarp on each field when the storm's coming in?
Go ahead, Dad.
We normally send the crew from one stadium down to help drag tarp on the other. If it's important enough, the 8-man crew can drag a tarp, but the umpire in that case has to make sure that he calls a game in time. So it's not enough time, waiting us down. If that's the case, we 8 men can drag that tarp. Otherwise, we normally, if we have enough notice, those 8 will go down to one stadium and 16 will pull it there and then go to the other stadium and pull it up there. But sometimes it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things the game manager has to understand, and Paul, you understand this, is give us time. If you see it's going to rain or starting to rain, don't wait till it's too heavy to call the game and then wonder why we can't drag the tarp on.
Sure. Amazing. all with volunteers. You know, some of these volunteers now, you've had enough volunteers around long enough to have guys who are really experienced with working with tarps now. But in the early days, I bet that was a little more interesting when you had a lot of people who probably had never worked with a tarp before.
Never seen a piece of plastic that big with handles before.
Yeah. Or known what to do with it. More importantly, when a thunderstorm wind comes in.
Yeah. And that's a problem. Doesn't matter whether we're talking about Little League Baseball or Major League Baseball, is waiting too long to pull a tarp.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be somebody in charge saying, now go here, up, down. And if that person isn't available, that havoc is created, because a lot of the people have never pulled tarps before.
So what would
one of the really neat things about Little League is they have really come to rely on us as a grounds crew. They'll come to us and say, you know, it looks like it's going to rain. Come and watch radar with us. You tell us when you want to pull this thing.
Right. Unlike
Major League Baseball, where it kind of gets ruled to others.
Yes.
You know, Little League very much relies on us to help them make the decision. Boy, that looks like it has some wind. If we can get on it earlier than later, while it may not be raining when we put it on, we're going to have a whole lot better chance of doing it. So we've done very well in building that relationship with them so that they rely on our expertise as well.
That's spectacular that you've got that kind of, I don't know if the word is pull you know, they just view that your professional experience that all of you folks have dealt with, that they know that you guys have the better experience on hand to listen to you. So that's nice to have. What would you say is the biggest challenge in working this event?
I think probably we just talked about it for a little while there, and that's weather.
Yeah, as always.
I mean, our record in the tournament is now a 10-day tournament. Our record, and this is not a record we're proud of, but it's a record that in a 10-day period of a tournament, about 8 years ago, we pulled the tarp 26 times.
Wow.
Over the course of a 10-day tournament. And that's with 1 day off for rain. So That was multiple times a day, off and on. And
those are never keeping fun.
Volunteers encouraged about having fun at a tournament and volunteering to be there when they know they're going to get soaking wet and have to have wet seats for 10 days is probably the biggest challenge that comes to me. There's lots of others, obviously, but that's a big one.
Well, you know, to an outsider, you know, the challenge you would think would be getting volunteers, but from the sounds of it, that's actually getting better and better with each year as more people want to share in the experience, it sounds like.
I have a waiting list that's 10 people deep.
Yeah, that's
which I would rather have, quite honestly, than having them come, you know, have 40 guys there during the course of the series and not have it be a positive experience because we don't have work for them to do.
Sure. Yeah. There's nothing worse than standing around.
Right. So we put in those rotational positions that we can rotate people off and get new people in there. Not because we didn't love having the guys that were there around. Just trying to make it a positive experience for anybody who comes to Williamsport.
Don, do you have another challenge you can think of besides the weather?
No, just keep it on schedule. And as I said, with the two stadiums, it's a lot easier to maintain the schedule, and that's the challenge we had with only one stadium. But now that we've got two, we've got more time between, so it really takes the biggest challenge we had out of play.
Sure. Don, do you still go, or have you gotten to the point where you just say, you know what, my son's got it under control, I'm just going to let him deal with it?
I think that's probably true. I don't.
But he still goes.
Hard to walk away.
My big question to him anymore is, what time do we eat?
Yeah. Hey, you know, and I'll be the first one to tell you that a ground crew travels on its stomach. let's get the timing down. So you're still going, Don, it sounds like, for the most part.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And Jeff, when did you start getting involved then?
Dad and I were just talking about this earlier. I did not go the first year that CAFMO went to help out. I was actually there because they asked Dad to throw out the first pitch at one of the games, and he had called that morning and said, "Hey, well, I'm throwing out the first pitch tonight." I said, "Good. We'll be there." So we drove across the state and went to that. So I wasn't there on the grounds crew that year. My first year was the next year, which would have been 96. Mm-hmm. I've been gone ever since.
And now this year, you guys have a new groundskeeper to work with there as well.
We do. There's a permanent groundskeeper that's in Williamsport year round. And we were very fortunate to have one there for 4 years who had been through the mill a couple of times, so to speak, and knew what to expect. But this year we have a new one, a gentleman by the name of Rob Guthrie. Rob came from a golf background, but had some baseball in his past. Has been doing a fantastic job. I've been checking on him throughout the summer, making my normal summer visits to Williamsport just to check on fields and status for. And looking forward to having him be the head guy through the series this year.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be a little bit different from working around golf course work with once he sees all the media and TV that's involved in this. and I would imagine that ESPN probably supplies the worldwide feed, I'm sure. So, you know, for the most part, they're controlling the media for around the world, but you've still got all the reporters from all the different parts of the world that are coming for this, I would imagine.
Yeah, ESPN does control the feed for the actual games, but there will literally be hundreds of reporters, either for written media or televised media from around the world. The Japanese group always has a TV crew that follows them wherever they go, where they're allowed to go, obviously, because there are restricted areas on the complex that media is not allowed to interact with the kids.
That's good.
But there will be, Yeah. They have the International Grove, which is where the kids stay during the course of the 2 weeks that they're there. Only credentialed folks are allowed in there. The team hosts and those kind of folks, players, coaches, managers. There are Little League employees who are not allowed inside the International Grove during the tournament. So media can't access them there, which is nice for the kids.
Good.
Yeah, and actually, Little League does a good job of protecting the kids from too much media and that kind of stuff. Even not just there, but you get out into the regular Little Leagues around the country, there are some pretty strict rules in their rule books about how the kids' images and things can or cannot be used in photos or things like that. So the league does a good job of that.
Yes, they do.
Have either of you seen any kids who have gone through there over the past 20 years who have gone on to play in Major League Baseball?
Winner of the Home Run Derby this year.
Yeah.
There have been some, but I don't know who they would have been.
Normally, you're not following them when you're busy on the ground crew.
Yeah. But the Home Run Derby winner this year at the Major League All-Star Game played for the team out of New Jersey when we were there, when they won it all back in the 90s.
Tom's River.
He played for Tom's River.
Huh. I'll be darned. That's pretty cool. How many total number of fields on the Little League complex are there? There's the two championship fields, and then how many practice fields are there?
There are two 60-foot practice fields, full-size fields, and then there is a half field. So there's 2.5 60-foot fields, and then there's one 90-foot field that they don't use during the tournament, obviously. So there are 2.5 on the complex plus the two stadium fields. And then directly across the street, there is a South Williamsport Community Park that there are two additional fields down there that they use as well. Hmm. So 4.5 fields plus the two stadium fields is basically what we help them with.
You look at it on Google Earth or whatever your choice of satellite is, and it doesn't look like a very big place. And it's just set in this little tiny town. It's got to be an interesting setting, and I can't imagine what it's like for the town annually to have this massive media blitz and international visitors for this each year.
It is spectacular. The town really embraces Little League Baseball. They host a parade of champions on Wednesday night. So all the teams have floats that they go through the parade, and the community really comes out and supports it. It's a festival of sorts. The local community comes out, and they're walking around in the evenings just like it's a county fair or an arts festival, just to support the event. It's pretty spectacular.
Huh. So do you get really excited as the date nears for it to get going?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Don.
We get in there on Monday before the series starts and work pretty hard. And yes, we get excited to see the series start and finally start playing games. And in my case, I look forward to going back every year. And right now that anticipation just grows and grows and can't wait to get there. But it's always neatest part when the games start.
Yeah.
We can work hard and get ready, but you're always looking forward to that first game getting going.
You want to see the fans filling the stadium and hearing the roar of the crowd, sure.
Yep. Biggest crowd we ever saw there was when Clinton County, Pennsylvania was playing. I think there were like 45,000 people at that little complex at one of the stadiums.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That particular night, we were bigger than 11 major league stadiums. we had a bigger attendance than 11 of the 13 games that were going on in the major leagues that night.
that is something to say about the popularity of this event.
And there's only bleacher seats for about 7,000. So the other...
All the rest are on the hill.
33,000 are on the hill.
I don't think I want to be on that hill if a rainstorm hits.
Yeah.
Depends on how old you are, Paul. If you're just a little kid, that's when you want to get on the hill so you can slide down it on
Get a piece of cardboard. Yeah, exactly. So, Jeff, you head down there when?
I will go Sunday. I forget the dates. The 10th, 16th. The Sunday before the tournament starts.
Okay.
And basically that is to prepare so I can make sure that housing is in place and, you know, our cooks have the space that they need and kind of get myself organized before everybody else starts showing up on Monday.
Yeah,
because our crew will start coming in Monday.
The tournament at South Williamsport begins on the 20th of August with the world champion then being crowned on the 30th. And this is going to be the 57th year of the World Series held there in South Williamsport out of the 69 years total that they've been doing this. Quite a long run.
Yeah.
Don and Jeff, you guys have been fantastic. All I can say is have a lot of fun out there besides doing some work. Hopefully it stays fairly dry for you guys during the 10-day run of the tournament. And wish you guys great success, and along with Rob Guthrie, the new groundskeeper out there, we hope you guys pull off a great show, and we'll be watching on TV as everybody else will around the world.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For all of you Diamond Da Vinci's out there who are busy this time of year painting your fields, whether it be for baseball, soccer, or the upcoming football season, Beacon Athletics can help you complete your on-field masterpieces. We have a full offering of string lines, stencils, templates, painting machines, and paint. Beacon can provide custom field stencils to promote your organization, club, or school. Then, to paint it, we offer various bulk paints like Beacon's own Dazzle line, or try the likes of World Class or Combi Premium paints with many vibrant colors available. And for touch-ups, we also have World Class and Goal Line brand aerosol turf paints. To apply your bulk paints, Beacon carries the top-of-the-line Graco Field Laser S100 or the Powerliner 850 airless line sprayers. These gas-powered machines can handle the big jobs, but for the smaller jobs, we also have the battery-powered Field Laser S90 and the Combi. So let your creative imagination run wild. Check out our web store at www.beaconathletics.com or call our experienced sales staff at 800-747-5985. And let us help equip you with your brushes, paint, and palette to bring your masterpieces alive.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into our special subject discussion. Paul, you'll be delighted. We're not talking about turf grass science today.
Oh, thank the Lord. A break.
You jerk. Ah, jeez. Nice. You know, if I wanted this abuse, I would go someplace else. I really do want to talk about the fundraising today, though. I think it's not just a good show for it, but, you know, you and I have been talking about this over and over while we've been setting up some of our other shows. It's really hard to find the money sometimes. And I think it can be a little easier if you have not just a plan, but if you have justification behind that plan, saying these are the tools we want, this is why we want those tools, this is the results we expect if we get this money, these tools, and this program set up. Is that right? Do you agree?
Well, so much of fundraising, or so much of budgeting, or I don't know how you classify this, but it's rooted in areas way before that. You know, I get a lot of people asking me, I do more teaching of how to raise money and how to organize your league from our customers here than I get with, well, what kind of tools should I have? because it seems like there's a lot of leagues that are maybe a little discombobulated, disoriented, not sure what to do. You know, most of the time you hear, well, we don't have any money. Well, in my opinion, it's your fault that you don't have the money, because you have all the power in the world to raise the money.
Mm-hmm.
What you need is good organization, and you need people who are going to follow through and do the work, and you need somebody to set the vision. So, you know, my first rule is the board. the board of the league, whether it's a youth league or a recreational league, if there's a board that oversees that kind of thing. Typically with most youth leagues like Babe Ruth and Little League and all that, there is a board that runs it. And I've, from my experiences at our Little League, one of the reasons ours has been so successful is that a lot of the board members are not fathers or in some cases mothers with kids currently in the organization. They've already aged out. They're past that. So we got people who are actually staying behind because they got into it and liked it.
Oh, I see.
Now, why is that so important? Because it's these people who become the long-term people who will look long-term down the road at what needs to be done. They set up a long-range plan and they stick to it and they use it as the guide and stay to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're run by a board that's all current parents who have kids playing, from what I've seen, the problem is that they're very short-sighted. They're sometimes, a lot of times, they're, I just want to be on the board to make sure that my kid gets on the All-Star team. You know, it happens, and there's a lot of that happening.
Yeah, there's so politics everywhere. Right?
They're really not interested in what's happening long range. They just care about getting their kid on the All-Star team, or they've got some special thing they only want to take care of, and then their kid ages out and they're gone. Mm. And one of the big complaints about boards is that the turnover. Mm-hmm. So the less turnover you have for at least half of the board, the better chance you have of having long-range plans, and that includes long-range plans for groundskeepings. And that's how I started out with the Little League. They asked me to, they tapped me on the shoulder one day when I was there, and they said, "We really need your help." And I said, "Yeah, I can see that." And they said, would you mind coming and talking to our long-range plan? So I, planning committee. So I said, okay. So I went to the meeting, and I said, "Show me your long-range plan." They had been together for 2 years, this committee. They had nothing.
Oh, my.
I said, "What do you mean you have nothing? What have you been doing for the past 2 years? Give me 2 weeks, and I'll come back with a long-range plan." 2 weeks later, I came back with a 14-page long-range plan. Mm-hmm. It spelled out everything that needed to be done for the next 5 years to get these fields up and the facility up to par, what it was going to cost to do each thing, very detailed,
mm-hmm.
when it was going to be done over that 5 years. I had it scheduled because there are certain steps you want to do before other steps, and how we were going to fund it. And we took it to the league, to the board. You know, the committee got very excited about, "Oh, this is great. This is what we need." We took it to the board. We explained it to them. And the board said, no.
Huh.
And at the time, there was a battle going on in our board.
Politics.
Young people coming in and old people there who said, "You know, this isn't Major League Baseball. This is Little League. We've been playing this way for 50 years. Mm. It's fine." And the young
people—that's what I thought you were going to say—was the problem with the old timers. I thought you were going to go down this path. Okay,
but they didn't. But at the time, that was a problem. But the young people saw the potential of what I was proposing to them, and so I got a call later that night after the meeting because all I was able to do was present, and then I had to walk out. I didn't get to hear the vote,
mm-hmm.
and they said, "Well, you know, it didn't happen." So I said, "Okay, I'll tell you what." I said, "Do you guys got any money left over?" And they go, "Yeah," and I said, "Well, what we're going to do is we're going to force this on the board." I said, "I want to get anything that's colorful and into your face and do it to the fields. And we're going to address some issues. We needed a fence cap to protect the kids on the fences because our fences weren't very high, 4 foot, 5 foot, you know, easy to hang a kid's armpit up on one of those things and damage them for their career. Backstop padding, mound and home plate tarps, which the coaches had been screaming for, but the current groundskeeper at that time was saying, "Oh, I don't want to get tarps because they'll never put them on." And I said, "Well, if you educate why you're putting them on, then they'll put them on." You know, we got windscreen for the fence. You know, so it was all these bright visual things that were happening. So opening day comes the fun the next year, and the fans coming in there, the families go nuts. They're coming up to the board members, "Oh, I love what you did to this place," and they're shaking their hands, and the board went, So they said, "You know, I think we'll let you rebuild that infield on the major field this coming year."
So they gave me some money.
And so then we redid that. And, of course, rave reviews the next year. And that was it. Once I got past that, they went with the exact program I had laid out, and we went from there. We went from a program that at the time was only – had $180,000 a year revenue stream to $500,000 8 years later.
So what you're saying is get yourself a major league groundskeeper No. No, get somebody who is can organize and put together these thoughts in a way that will stick around. So it's on paper. You know, people have copies of it. You know, you email it. You share it with a lot of people.
You use it as the Bible.
And you use it as your, yes, as your as your guidepost. And something that is not going to need to change much, you know, maybe the pricing here and there, but something that really lays it out and in detail.
So there's your plan of what you need to do and what your goals are. And so you use that as a guide, and you do revisit it every couple years to update things, because you can check off what's done. You can rearrange some things that you mm-hmm. might have learned. Okay, we got to change that kind of stuff. So that's the board's part. Now, get the board out of the way. Let's move to the next part.
Okay.
Do you own your complex,
or are you about this.
Or are you playing on park and rec fields?
Yeah, because if you're playing on government owned fields, that drastically changes your how much latitude you have, doesn't it?
Well, it changes a couple things. Theoretically, it means you don't need as much money.
Oh, okay.
If you own your own complex, it means you need a lot of money, because it costs money to maintain a field. And that was the problem with our little league. When I first got there and I wrote the first check for my son to play there, I said, is that all? That's all this is? That's too little. No wonder the place is falling apart. They're not charging enough to take care of the facility properly. Mm. And Little League is partially to blame. Little League International was partially to blame, but because they were really strong-arming organizations to, you know, please keep it as cheap as possible so more kids can play. Well, we have an answer for that. So
I knew you would.
Yeah. So if you don't charge enough, you can't take care of the facility. You gotta be in line. So if you own your own complex, make sure you're charging enough money to pay for all the maintenance that is involved, along with all the things you need, baseballs, uniforms, all that other kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. If you're using park and rec fields, the park and, you know, you hear people say, well, you know, we play on park and rec fields, and you know, those damn parks people, they won't do anything. Well, the parks people don't have any money.
Right. Yeah. They've got slashed budgets too.
And they can't raise it.
Right.
But the league who's using it can raise all the money it wants. Mm. And I tell people.
And earmark it.
Yeah. I tell people, I say, those parks would love to do whatever you want, but they need money to do it. And you can raise it. Mm-hmm. You can buy the materials they need. You can build, you know, you can get an agreement with them where they'll allow you to build the press box or the dugouts or whatever it is that you need. Mm-hmm. So you have the power to raise that money. They don't. So if you think that because you're on a park field, you can't do anything, you're wrong. Mm. And you just need to work with the parks department, and they will do what they can for you, but they'll tell you what they can't do. And in a lot of cases, you'll find that it's something that you can do for them. Mm. And they'll be thrilled to death. Hmm. So
let's revisit the costs, you know, because we don't want to exclude children who may not have the higher registration amounts.
Right. The way we do that is we have never, our organization has never, ever turned away a kid, ever. If a kid wants to play, we offer scholarships.
And that's in your literature?
It's in our literature, either full or partial scholarships. Most of the kids play partial scholarships because most parents want to pay something, but they don't have to pay the full price. And the way we work it is, if you are getting free or reduced meals at school, you're eligible for these scholarships.
Okay.
And we average about 75 kids a year in our program. We have a total of, Summer ball and fall ball, we do about 1,500 kids. Mm-hmm. So about 75 of those over the course of the year will get scholarships. And maybe...
I'm surprised there's not more, but yeah.
Yeah. And well, it grew quite a bit over the past, when we hit the recession, it grew considerably.
Oh,
But it's usually been pretty small. We might do a handful of full scholarships in the course of a season. Most people are willing to pay, you know, a very reduced amount of 30.
Oh, and we're going to have to pause. Hey there to our listeners at home. Sorry about that. We had a minor glitch and we are restarting. So let's start this conversation again. Paul, we were talking about getting the kids in on scholarship.
Yeah. So I think before I ended up, I got to the point where I had said that, you know, we have maybe a handful of kids who get a full scholarship over the year, but most parents want to give something. And I think it's important because if they give a little something, they feel more ownership than if they get it for free. There was one, at one point in time, we gave everybody free scholarships. But what was happening was kids would come for one or two games, and then they'd not show up again. Oh. And the problem was they would take the place of somebody who might have wanted to get on there.
Yeah.
So we had learned through some of the other organizations around our area that they said what they do with their scholarship people is they make them pay a minimal amount, and that creates ownership, and they make sure then the kids come all the time.
Yeah.
So scholarships is how we handle that, and that's all funded through the league. And that's what happens. Some of it's we get some of that money through fundraising. People will give money for the scholarship fund to help pay for those kids. The rest is just built in out as part of our operating expenses.
Okay, great.
So now, speaking of registration costs, and I talk about not having enough money, your registration costs should cover at least half of your operating costs. Now, the interesting thing is when I first started with our league, they didn't even have an operating budget. And when I got on the board, I reamed them for that.
Wow.
I said, how can you not? No wonder you can't plan ahead. You don't even have a budget.
Yeah.
So, of course, I opened my mouth, and guess who got stuck being put in charge of making a budget? It was me, right? But the way I look at it is, he who makes the budget controls the money.
Well, that's a good point.
But you want to make sure that your registration costs are covering half of what your total operation costs are.
Okay.
And then from there, you know, what I also recommend is you survey all the youth sports organizations around you and find out what everybody else is charging.
You don't want to price yourself out either. Yeah.
We are still the best bargain in town, yet we're one of the highest costing little leagues in the area. Although everybody has, as we've moved up, all the other little leagues have followed us right in our footsteps.
Good.
But we're the leaders in setting it. So you want to take a look at those registration costs of the other sports and kind of put yours comparatively to that. But you also, again, have to look at if you own your complex, you're going to need more money because you maintain the complex.
Yeah. And there is an operating budget, yes, for people who are using government fields, who are using park and rec fields or school-owned fields, correct?
That's correct, yes, yeah. Yes. So even if you're working on those fields, even if you're using those fields, your organization still has some kind of a budget because you still got to buy uniforms. You might be paying umpires, buying baseballs. It's all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You're still going to have some kind of an operating budget. So you should know that. The other thing I find interesting, and I've learned this through going. Being involved with sports with my son as he grew up, it was interesting to find that in big cities, if you're an organization, a youth organization in a big city, in my opinion, it's a lot harder to get people to sponsor you because there's so many distractions in the big city and you become the small potatoes.
Yep.
You've got, for instance, here in Madison, we've got the University of Wisconsin Athletics, which takes a lot of the money that's out in the area here that people donate goes to University of Wisconsin Athletics. That makes us a small potato. It makes it harder for us to find it. But if you go out to the small towns, what you'll often find is in small town America, it's the youth sports that provide and the recreational leagues that provide the entertainment for the small towns. Mm. And they typically, you go to a lot of these small
Good
places,
point.
the ice arenas, the little league complexes, and damn near every business has a sign up there, and they're paying for that sign space.
Yep.
So I really am amazed at how small towns rally around their youth athletics because of that, because it is the entertainment. In the big cities, that's where you struggle.
Well, and in the big cities, you've got to learn where to look. You've got to look in your local neighborhood.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't go to the nationally owned chain of plumbers, let's say. Guess who's thinking about plumbing lately? you go to the guy from your neighborhood who does a good job, who wants to service other people in that neighborhood or within that district. And that's where you start looking, or you start, you know, going to restaurants and all of that, people who have a vested interest in your part of the community.
Right. So sponsorships play a key role for us. We have sponsorships for teams, and we have sponsorships for signage.
Mm-hmm.
We have sponsorships for individual parts of the complex. We've got a picnic porch that's sponsored by by a place that they paid a 20-year deal to have their name on that, and that was a big deal for us. So you've got all these different types of sponsorships. You have to kind of learn how to price them. Our sign deals and our team sponsorships for us are 3-year deals. And what we do is we say, you know, we take that 3-year sponsorship cost and we bill them annually. We break it down into 3 even costs. If they pay it all up front, they get a break. We give them, you know, whatever it is, a couple $100 off or whatever. So we've got the, if we break it into the 3-year deal into 1-year payments, then you're getting annual money coming in every year.
Mm-hmm.
And that just rotates. And so you have somebody on your board who's in charge of fundraising and who oversees that kind of stuff and keeps track of all the contracts and all that kind of things and bills them out. And then we bill that. What we do is we bill those out at the end of our fall ball season. So October, November. Why for us is that time period the best? Because that's when our costs are the low, our money coming in is the worst.
Okay.
And we need money to operate even during that time. We have an executive director we have to pay because we're a big operation.
Yeah.
We have a lot of kids. We need to have an executive director, so we pay an executive director. There is some groundwork still being done into November, so we got ground crew working. We've got to be able to fund that. We have an emergency fund that we have built up over the years. We keep that stock so we don't run out of money, so we can always make sure we pay these people. All those kind of things. So sponsorships play a big role. But next to registration, which is 50% of your money, concessions are going to be your next biggest. If you can do concessions in any way possible, you want to be able to do those. 50% markup on product, and that helps. That helps for us. That's another 25 to 30% of our income. So between registrations and concessions, you're talking 70 to 80% of our income right there.
That's great.
So really, it's only the fundraising part of sponsorships and that kind of stuff that really is only a 20 to 30% amount of our income coming in. And you can get creative with a lot of these sponsorship things of naming different things. We're doing a capital campaign right now, and we've got a lot of our different portions of our park that you can name for you know, a certain price, those kind of things. But you got to be really creative. A lot of what I brought to the table to the organization was what I learned in Major League Baseball, and through experience over time, the board and we've worked out other ways of coming up with things. Now, the thing you got to be careful of is things get sour after a while. Golf outings, you know,
they get
surprisingly
old.
Enough. They get old. Bowlathons. So you're always trying to reinvent the wheel, and of course you have to keep it kids oriented. If you really want the true impact. So those are just some of the things I've learned over my almost 15 years now working in Little League Baseball.
So when you get ready to start a fundraising campaign, let's say for the capital campaign or for one project in particular. Can you kind of break that down into a couple of different points for us for where to start and how to get that up and running? Where you've had the most success? What steps have you taken where you've had the most success?
Yeah, well, the best thing to do there is, first of all, you've got to sit down and you really got to think out the whole project or whatever it is that you're going to do. Figure out all the steps of the project. Figure out all the entities that have to come in and do something for that project. Budget it out. Now you've got the cost that you need. Now you got to start finding where you're going to get that money. Well, the first thing you're going to go to is you're going to go to the list of parents that are in your organization. And if you're smart, what we collect, one of the things we collect in the registration is, who does mom and dad work for? Because then you go, hey, you work for Ace Plumbing. We need water plumbed into the new concession stand. Do you think you guys could donate some time or donate some materials or whatever? Anything you can do to bring costs down. If they don't, then you start hitting up the other plumbing shops around and see if you got somebody. Or you might already have an established plumbing company that you do a lot of work with. And that's the case with us. We have a lot of established people that we do work with. Sometimes we'll ask for for help.
Mm-hmm.
There are other times when I won't. I am very faithful to the vendors that we use at our complex, and they know that.
Mm.
And I don't question them. And I know their costs are fair because I've dealing with lots of other ones, so I know roughly who's fair or not. And you call a favor when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other times that they're a business like everybody else. They got to make money. There are times that you got to pay the bill.
Yep.
And so you gotta kind of balance that out. But yeah, find out who all of your parents work for, because lots of times those are huge places where you can make big dents in a fundraising situation by getting some comp help or that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things to look at as well.
Yeah.
Once you get past that and you know what you're going to get for free or what you're going to get at a reduced rate, then you really know the true amount that you've got to raise. So now you start creating a campaign. And again, it helps to know who the parents are who make the more money or who have money to give. Or, you know, in our organization, we've got families now, because we're an old organization, who have their third generation going through the organization.
Wow.
Those families are great because they've seen the benefit of what it does for the organization,
mm-hmm.
or what it does for the neighborhoods and whatnot, and they are usually more than willing to pay. Look for grants, whether they're state grants, local municipality grants, depending on what it is you're working on. Those are the kind of things you want to look for. Baseball Tomorrow Fund, which I just finished doing a grant write-up for that, and I'm going to tell you, it's like filling out a federal grant. It is massive, and it's a pain in the rear end. But
they've got so many people asking them, they got to make sure they can weed everyone out.
But they give out a lot of money in the course of a year, and
yes,
they give
they
it
do.
Out four times a year. Every quarter, they're making more awards, and so it's not like it's you got no shot in hell,
right?
Because you can continue to reapply if you don't win.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good exercise. It was hard because it's that grant in particular is a thick grant, and you got to supply a lot of documments.
If you have somebody in the parent pool who works at a university and has ever applied for funding, see if you can get them on to do your grant writing. It is
absolutely
a skill. It is a talent. Yeah.
Yes. Knowing the buzzwords and the right way to phrase it is
exactly.
is a special talent. You are absolutely right. And if you have, we hired a grant writer is what we did. And she's been great so far. They are well worth their money. They can help you out. And they also have, a lot of times, they also have contacts.
Yeah.
Of knowing where else to look for other things. So sometimes they can be a big help as well.
Yep. Cool.
So hopefully that tied it together for you.
Yeah, I think that's great.
So
we'll leave this open. If you guys have some questions that are specific, go ahead and email us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Email us. Yeah.
Email Paul. I don't know.
I've had plenty of experience, and I can talk for hours this kind of stuff, and there's just not enough time in the podcast. And I love talking to organizations about these kind of things because there's just so much information out there about that's needed on how to do these kind of things and how to fund it and how to plan things. But the big thing is you got to have a plan, and you got to have somebody looking out for the long-term vision. And if you don't have that, that all comes back to the board. If you don't have that, you'll never get there.
Yep. Absolutely.
And with that means it's time to shut the books on this show. Be sure to tune in to our next show when we speak to Roger Baird and Justin from the Chicago Cubs. About what's going on at Wrigley Field with all of their updates that they're going to be doing to the ballpark there over the next couple of years, and that they've already started in this past year. And the best part is it's all free because, let's face it, folks, only my mom is going to pay to listen to hear me talk.
Or my mother-in-law. She listens. Yay.
Oh, yeah. That's only because she's there this week.
No, my mom's here this week. My mother-in-law is the one who listens.
Oh, it's the mother-in-law's.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. So your mom doesn't listen to you.
Nope. Our official webpage for the show can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find our show notes, which include any papers or links or photos that we discussed during the episode. We also have our pictures and bios up there if you're still curious about who you're listening to. And we also throw up some bonus material from time to time from our George Toma interview. Please go check it out. I I looked forever and ever, and I finally found that Sports Center commercial that he was in, and it's still pretty funny.
I know a lot of you folks listen on iTunes, and I think it's critical that you get over to the official webpage of the broadcast on the Beacon Athletics website, because there is a lot of information on there that we put up additional to our shows, links to different things. So if you can, when you're listening to them, jump on there and take a look at that kind of stuff.
Pictures of Godzilla.
There you go, yes. We'd love to hear from you. You can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your question or comments on the show, good or bad. Or if you got show ideas, send them along to us as well.
And if you're a Twitter follower, our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's @DiamondDaVincis. We're not crazy active there, but we do share links, and we will be putting out more teasers to the show as I start getting more active on there myself. So,
the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I bid you adieu.
Adios.